This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kuser. And today we're on a journey of scientific discovery that will help deepen our understanding of primates and dinosaurs. We begin with primates. And our guide is Dr. John Flegel. Dr. Flegel is a professor of anatomical sciences at Stony Brook University's Renaissance School of Medicine. He has investigated and researched many aspects of evolutionary biology of higher primates for more than 50 years. He's also the 2023 winner of the Charles Darwin Lifetime Achievement Award. And Dr. Flegel joins us now via Zoom. Professor, welcome to The Full Story.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Certainly. And first of all, congratulations on the award. Well deserved.
Well, thank you.
What does it mean for you to be a recipient of an award like this, a Lifetime Achievement Award?
Well, it's obviously quite an honor to be chosen by my association, the association that I've been a member of all biological anthropologists, and to have their committee decide I deserved a lifetime award was a surprise for a start, and then it's a real honor that your colleagues have decided that the way you spent your life was admirable and valuable.
Tell us a bit more about the association, if you would, that you just mentioned, the American Association of Biological Anthropology. Who are the members?
Well, it's mainly people at universities and museums who are investigating humans, basically from a biological point of view. There are lots of different parts. Obviously, what I do is mostly paleoanthropology, so mm-hmm. I look at fossils of early humans and the primates that gave rise to the human lineage. But there are other people who study the behavior of living primates in the field or in zoos, looking at aspects of their behavior. Geneticists fall under biological anthropology. People who do forensics, skeletons and teeth and things that are found in archaeological excavations and things like that. What do we know about these people? How did they live? What kind of growth did they have and things like that? And then there's just sort of evolutionary medicine, you know, how do different people grow up? How do different people have different body proportions, and how's that related to various aspects of their biology and behavior?
Quite a wide variety.
So it's a fairly broad field. It's sort of anthropology, which is the study of humans, but as the name implies, from a biological aspect.
When it comes to primates evolution, you basically wrote the book on it, Primate Adaptation and Evolution, and it's described as the text of choice for courses on the subject. What attracted you to study primates, their biology and their evolution? What was the impetus for you to get deeply involved in that?
Well, like many things, I think, in people's careers, in my case, it was almost an accident. It was an accident. I was a physics major as an undergraduate, and I was a work study student. So after my freshman year, I worked, you know, cleaning tables in the dining hall. And then in later years, you move up to things that are more interrelated to academic things. So I went into the person who was going to give me a job for the second, third, and fourth years of my undergraduate career. And the guy says, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I'm a physics major. And he said, well, physics is very sophisticated stuff, requires a lot of background. They don't really deal with undergraduates. They only hire postdocs and graduate students. I said, well, what else do you have? And he says, well, I have a job with this guy at the museum who seems to study human evolution or something. And I thought, okay. That sounds like a good job. So I started working in a laboratory of a person who studied primate evolution. And over the next year, I went to Wyoming and collected fossils. And I went to India and collected fossils. And I went to Egypt and collected fossils. And at the end of that year, I said, gee, I think this is a pretty good way to make a living. This is really fascinating stuff. There's a lot to do. There are lots of questions, and it's sort of exciting to actually see what happened in history. And that's what I've been doing for the last 50 years.
Could you define for us, so we all are sort of working from a similar understanding, the word primate? What is a primate exactly?
It's a group of mammals. So there are lots of different groups of mammals. There are, you know, rodents, which are, you know, rats and squirrels and things. There are artiodactyls, which are antelopes and cows and you know, big four-footed things. And then there are primates, which are a group of other mammals. So like other mammals, we give birth to young and we nurse our young. And the way our jaws and skulls are put together are pretty much the same as other mammals. But this is the group of mammals that separated from other mammals, so say 65 or so million years ago. And over the last 65 million years gave rise to tree shrews and lemurs and tarsiers and monkeys and chimpanzees. And more recently, humans. They are our cousins, our biological cousins.
Do you study the whole group, or are there specific primates that you focus on?
I have focused on monkeys and apes, as opposed to other more primitive animals that may be found in different parts. So I study monkeys and apes, which are found in some in South America, in Africa, and in Asia, and in previous time periods, there were also some in Europe.
And in your book, you examine fossils to track how primates evolved, how those primates evolved. Is that correct?
Yes, how they evolved through time and how the history of the group may, you know, differ from what we see today. So the animals that we see today are the result of 65 million years of evolution, but also some environmental things that may have happened in more recent times. There's obviously been a lot of extinctions and climates have changed. So how was this group of animals, how have they changed over the past 60 million years?
And you mentioned South America, Africa, other parts of the world. Are those the areas where the fossils that you study were found?
Yes, I've been very fortunate and been able to do paleontological field work in lots of different continents. I started off working in Egypt, and then I've worked in other places in Africa, Ethiopia, Kenya. And then because the primates from Africa are closely related to the primates from South America, I've also worked in Argentina to try to find out where the monkeys in South America, how they got there, when they got there, and how they're related to the other primates in other parts of the world.
Interesting that there's a relationship between the groups separated by an ocean, but are we talking about a relationship that was established before that ocean separated the continents of Africa and South America?
Well, that's been a big debate, and the answer is no. What you see today the ones in South America have very distinctive features compared to the ones that you find today in Africa and Asia. It turns out that there have been monkeys in South America for about the last 30 million years. One of the groups, paleontological expedition I worked on in fairly recent years is one of my colleagues from California had been looking at the mammal evolution, and they thought, well, you know, this is a good time. We need to find some primates. So he asked me if I would work with them and one of my colleagues, and I said, sure, we would love to work there because we've been working on animals from about the same age in Africa, and it looks like the South American ones are most closely related to the ones in Africa, but they're very different today. So in fact, we went back to his fossil site and we dug up some fossils and we sent some back and started looking at them. And lo and behold, we found some little primate fossils that looked like they could have come from Africa. from exactly the same time period, which actually people had debated over. Well, gee, did they get to Africa, to South America by going through the north, go through Europe to Greenland, down through North America, or maybe come through the south, through Antarctica? But it turns out when they first appeared in South America was an island continent. It wasn't connected to North America at all. So they, and there are no fossil monkeys known from North America. So they almost certainly had to come across the South Atlantic Ocean.
What's it like when you make that kind of a discovery? As someone who watches this sort of thing on television, it always seems exciting when any kind of a fossil is discovered. What's the feeling that you get when you find something and when you discover something very unusual like you just described?
Well, it's very reassuring and very exciting, and for several reasons. First of all, I work on the fossil record, so the things I'm studying are things that are not alive today. So you're looking at things that, are different. They're not something you could find if you went to the zoo or somewhere else. They're things that no one's ever seen alive, and that's pretty exciting in itself. But in this particular case, when there's been a debate on when these monkeys got to South America, did they come from across the ocean when South America and Africa and other continents were separated? Or did they come around through the North America? Did they come from somewhere else? And when you suddenly see something that sort of you couldn't predict it to look more like, it looks like an African fossil. And that's really exciting because not only did you see something that no one's ever seen before, but it fits something that you might have predicted, but there are lots and lots of possibilities. And so it helps you solve a problem in addition to discovering something that's new and wonderful.
So when you find a fossil in an excavation, what's the work process there? How do you begin to study that? What do you look for?
Well, it varies in many different, basically depends upon the geology. In some cases, you're excavating a place and there might be lots and lots of skeletons and things, and it's obviously in sediments. It's in some sort of dirt or some sort of matrix, we call it. And in some cases, you're just picking away the dirt to trying to expose what you have in front of you, and trying to see how much of the animal's there. You have to do the geological work to find out how old the deposits are, what age they are. In other cases, like in this particular case, the fossils were very small. And they were in basically a riverbank. So the animals had obviously fallen into the river and they probably disintegrated, and their bones and teeth had been redeposited somewhere downstream. So what we did is we'd have to work very hard in pulling out the bones and sediments, bones and rocks and sand grains, and then we'd have to take them back to the lab to sort of sort out the stuff that's fossil and the stuff that's just dirt and sand. So it this one's a little bit longer. You, in the in the in the field, you sort of know you have some fossils in there, but they're fairly small. You couldn't see them exactly what you had, so you had to go back in the lab and clean the stuff up to actually see what you have.
You talked about the way some of the primates might have moved from the African continent to South America, which reminds me that you also study, I understand, primate locomotion. I assume that means how primates move. Why is that important?
Well, one of the things that, I mean, when you look at living primates or behavior of any animals, there are lots of things you can sort of determine from their skeleton. The shapes of their bones can sort of tell you how they moved. The shapes of their teeth can tell you what they ate. The size of their eyes can tell you whether they were active during the day or during the nighttime. So you can learn a lot about the behavior of fossils from different parts of their skeleton. I was particularly interested in how animals move. I realized, well, gee, when I dig up a fossil, it's not going to tell me much doesn't come with labels. So I have to know how the shapes of the living bones are related to the way living animals move, because they have both bones and behavior. So even though I was mainly interested in paleontology, I figured I ought to do my homework and go out and study animals moving in the wild, and then go to museums and look to see how their bones differ depending upon how they move. So I spent 3 years in graduate school following monkeys in the Malaysian jungles and writing down how they moved, and whether they were leapers or whether they ran on all fours, whether they ran on the ground or on branches. And then you could sort of look to see how the bones move in these different ways. And then once you find just a bone, it can tell you about what the behavior was like. I've been very lucky to be able to sort of look at all aspects. So I spent a lot of time in the field chasing monkeys. I've spent a lot of time in museums looking at the shapes of bones. And I spent a lot of time out in the field digging up bones.
Why is it important to study, to spend this amount of time and effort studying primates and how they evolved? What do we learn by it in the 21st century? Why is it relevant?
Well, we learn what our own history is like. I mean, if you want to know the history of your family, obviously you can, people have written things down and you can look things up. But if you want to know, we are, what we look like now, we have these long legs, we walk on 2 feet, we have the hands that are very good at grasping things. Well, where did these things come from? How do the features that distinguish humans from other animals, how did they come to be that way? What's the background that enabled us to become what we are? And so what I'm spending my time doing is trying to go back into the geological record to try to see, well, okay, what do our real ancestors, the ones that are 30 million years old, as opposed to the ones that are, three generations or 10 generations or even a million years.
Your book is in its third edition, went through a comprehensive revision because the knowledge has changed since you first wrote it. Have there been significant changes in our understanding of primate evolution since the first edition of your book? And if so, is the knowledge an evolution itself?
Oh, absolutely. Well, there's lots of things that have changed. First of all, there are always new. We don't find many new species, living animals, but the paleontological record grows every year. There are more people out looking and finding new fossils that tell us more about what the animals were like in different parts of the world and in different time periods. But then there are new ways of looking at evolutionary history, genetics. There's this tremendous amount of genetics that can tell us how animals, living animals, are related, and now how extinct animals may have been related. And there are mathematical ways of looking at the shapes in much more detail than we could do in the past, with things like CAT scans and three-dimensional shapes, that you can do things that you couldn't do before. You could sort of look at things in the past and, use your calipers and measure things, but now you can get three-dimensional images and have much more detailed ways of comparing bony shapes.
Now, I understand, too, you also study human evolution, specifically about the age of modern humans. The
Yes.
paleoanthropologist Richard Leakey and his colleagues wrote a paper on the fossils of Homo sapiens found in the, I believe it's pronounced, the Kibish Formation in Ethiopia.
Yes.
And they
Yes.
dated those remains to about 130,000 years old. But then more recent studies of the sediment there suggests that modern humans have been around quite a bit longer than that. Is that the case?
Yeah, it was very hard. And when they did their work back in the early 1970s or late 60s even, the ways of dating geological sediments weren't as well developed as they are today. And it was a tough place to work. It still is. One of my students, an Ethiopian guy I'd worked with, he said, gee, you know, why don't we go back to that place and see if we can find some more material? So I thought, well, that sounds exciting. Let's go. So we went back there, and we indeed took some very good geologists, and they went back all over the deposits there and tried to find out if we can get a better handle on exactly how old these fossils were. There were new techniques of dating geological sediments, and, you know, spend a little bit more time there than the Leakey group was able to spend, you know, so many years ago. So we went there for several years and had some new techniques and were able to sort of get a better handle on the age of those particular fossils. But in addition, there are now fossils from other parts of Africa that some of them look a little bit more definitely older than the fossils that we have. And so they seem to push the human lineage back a little bit further into fossils that we didn't even know, obviously, when we were there or when the Leakey group was there, like, you know, 50 years ago, 60 years ago.
Where do we as humans fit into the larger scheme of things? Are we one of the younger or the youngest primate? Are we sort of the newest version of this evolution?
No, humans are not the youngest group of primates. There are many animals, including humans, that are still changing. So, you know, as environments change, many of the primates that are living in other parts of the world are evolving themselves. So the animals that lived in some parts of Africa or South America or Asia 50,000 years ago, 100,000 years ago, are evolving to deal with a different climate than they were when they first evolved. So evolution is still taking place, both in humans and in other animals.
Do you think there are areas that are rich in fossils that perhaps we haven't discovered yet? This speculation, obviously, but you had mentioned there were more found since the 70s in Africa. Do you think there are rich deposits in other places around the planet?
Oh, almost certainly. There are obviously some things that you'll find in different, I mean, you know, you probably won't find any early humans in South America because we know people didn't get there until much later. But in Africa, there are many, many parts of that continent that, you know, maybe are hard to get to for pure physical reasons. And then there are always, in this business, there are always political issues. There are some places where one can go and do geological and paleontological work, and other places it's a lot more difficult. So new fossil deposits are being found all the time. And then there's just, you know, we always need more people to go to more places.
What does it mean?
I'm sure the story will continue to get more detailed with every year.
Regarding the discovery or the research that led to an understanding that Homo sapiens may have evolved earlier than we thought originally, what does that mean? Why is that important?
Well, it just gives you a time frame. Much of what we do is part of what we do. I've talked about is we find animals that were unknown before. We didn't even know that there were any of our primate relatives that looked the way animals look at different periods in the past. In this particular case, we're wondering about how old our particular relatives, the earliest members of our own genus, or the early members of our own lineage, the things that when we had separated from other types of fossil primates. Different places have different fossils. So the more you look back, you're going to find things. Oh, well, so how did humans move 3 million years ago is very different from the way they moved 1 million years ago, or even 50,000 years ago. So the way in which people behaved and what they looked like has changed. You know, we are not the type of animals that were in our lineage 2 million years ago. We have bigger brains, we have thinner limbs, and lots of other things. And how we went from an animal that looked so maybe more like a chimpanzee or gorilla to something that looks like the people you run into in the grocery store was a gradual change over, many millions of years. And trying to fill in how that took place requires a lot of work and a lot of looking in a lot of different parts of the world.
I wonder if we got along better with each other a million years ago. Probably nothing in
Probably,
the fossils to tell us.
If only because we were a fairly small group and we weren't spread out all over the world in lots of different continents. We started off as a fairly small group of people in Africa that eventually spread out to Europe and then spread out to Asia and then managed to wander across into North and South America and so forth. So when we were just one group, we probably got along fairly well, but maybe not too well, because some of them said, I'm not going to stay here any long. I'm going to go somewhere else and get away from you guys.
I'm wondering, too, are you at all concerned about the effects of climate change on fossil sites, possibility of losing some of those fossils due to sea level rising, storms, and what have you?
That's certainly the case. Certainly localities, and there are some places, that are really near the edge of the ocean that can disappear. For paleontology, it sort of works both ways, of course, because there are some places that might be underwater now in a lake, and they may suddenly become more available if it gets drier and the lake disappears. And then, it's a lot easier to look for fossils in a desert than it is in a jungle. So for paleontology, it works a little both ways. But for living as we like to live, obviously, we don't want to lose all of our water and to lose all of our oceans and lose all of our lakes and then have all our areas that are near oceans underwater.
What's next on your research agenda? What are you looking forward to working on?
Well, right now I'm mainly working on this South America and Africa change. The world's been pretty difficult the past 3 or 4 years. People aren't traveling very much. And then there are always political issues one has to deal with. So we're hoping to push back our work in South America that found these little African fossils and hopefully get a little bit more of them and get a better idea of how that event took place and when it took place and how many different animals there were that may have crossed from Africa to South America at that time.
Dr. John Flegel is a professor of anatomical sciences at Stony Brook University's Renaissance School of Medicine. Professor, thanks so much for your time. Fascinating work that you're doing, and we appreciate you sharing some of it with us today.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks a lot.
Now we go from primates to dinosaurs, a collection of dinosaur bones and fossils, to be precise. They're part of the biological archives at the Yale Peabody Museum of Natural History in New Haven. The collection is huge. It's immense. The vertebrate paleontology section alone has more than 80,000 specimens. A Yale student's taking a closer look at those remains. Chase Brownstein is a senior. He's studying ecology and evolutionary biology. He's also a research associate at the Stanford Museum and Nature Center. And he has already identified a new species of dinosaur. And Chase Brownstein joins me now via Zoom. Mr. Brownstein, welcome to The Full Story.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Certainly. Tell us more about the specific collection that you're working on. Is it the vertebrate collection?
Yeah, so it is vertebrates. I'm notoriously scatterbrained, so I like to work with anything I can get my hands on. In terms of the dinosaurs, a lot of that stuff started about 5 years ago when I got an interest in Eastern North American paleontology. So about 100 to 65 million years ago, Eastern North America and Western North America were split in two by a seaway And this seaway is actually why you get a lot of chalk deposits in Kansas. So if you have any Jayhawks in the audience, then they'll know about that.
So the Midwest, the American Midwest, is where the ocean or where the sea was at the time.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So that was called the Western Interior Seaway. Now, one really interesting thing about evolution is when you split continents and land masses in two, you tend to isolate those populations on, the individual land masses that are produced. And so that absence of sharing of genetic information between populations, what we call a gene flow, right, can lead to divergence. Because of that, and because of the fact that we know ecosystems are integrated communities and sets of interacting animals and plants and living things, you tend to get, different floras and faunas on different islands. So you think Galapagos. So this really interested me. And it was particularly interesting because Eastern North American paleontology is very, sort of poorly established, for dinosaurs at least, because of the fact that a lot of the material in the East is fragmentary. That's for a variety of reasons. It has to do with the fact we don't have big mountains like the Rockies out east that can't, produce enough sediment, right, to, cover up fossilized material. So sort of all these mysteries came together, and I sort of saw Eastern North America as a place to sort of think about evolution in isolation with a test case of dinosaurs. And so the Peabody Museum at Yale is I started coming here in high school, and then through college, has a great collection of early dinosaur fossils, or historically early discovered dinosaur fossils from Eastern North America that were discovered when, well, the great cities of the United States, the Eastern Seaboard, were being built. And those remains are historical, and they really feed into that question, which is, what's going on in Eastern North America during the age of the dinosaurs?
How did you get the job of taking a closer look at this particular collection, at these bones and fossils?
Yeah, essentially, way back, I think it was 2014, I was on a hike and I bumped into a curator at the Stanford Museum, and they allowed me to join on in because I had an interest in dinosaurs to work in revitalizing their collections and preparing for this exhibit. And from that, I was able to get recommendations to go into collections. And so then, I established a relationship here. And once they knew me and they knew I could take care of this stuff, it sort of worked out like that. But I was very fortunate to, sort of have those opportunities.
Are there other students working on the project with you?
In terms of the Eastern North American dinosaurs, that's sort of been a solo endeavor on my part. But I have worked with other students on a couple of other things. I worked on one Eastern North American dinosaur bone that actually has shark bites on it with a student in it was published in 2021. And then I've worked sort of in my more recent research, I look at, a variety of different groups of vertebrates. So, animals with a backbone. And these include fishes, jawless vertebrates like lampreys, and reptiles, so lizards and snakes. And this is, work that's been done with my advisor, Thomas Neer, and then, some other graduate students, professors.
The work you're doing with the Eastern North American collection, is this something the museum decided that needed a closer look, or was it through your specific interest in the region as you've described? Is that what drove the project?
Yeah, no, it was definitely a sort of a specific interest thing. Part of the thing is that, because of the fact that they're, rather more fragmentary than most dinosaur fossil sets from North America, no one had really been interested in sort of Eastern North American stuff. So it's actually kind of going through a renaissance right now. There is more interest, and so I like to think I was part of that, sort of group of people who sort of, in the mid 2010s kind of got a new interest in this group. In these fossils, and kind of ask the question of, what is going on out there? Yeah.
Maybe this is not a fair question, but do you have any idea how long it'll take to get through all of the specimens that that you want to look at in connection with the
Yeah.
North American collection?
Yeah. So it's funny because it's, a lot of them I've, been able to work on. So it's literally like a couple cabinets. I mean, it's kind of silly. Like, that's how sparse the record is. All of the theropod dinosaurs, which are the two-legged dinosaurs that actually include birds, all of the ones from Eastern North America that the Peabody has are in two small cabinets, and
Ah.
it's like 20 bones total. So it's, you have to get really good at identifying foot bones, And that ligament pull, ligament attachment pit and that process, on the bone is, things like that.
That's interesting. So, how do you examine a bone or a fossil? First of all, someone has determined that this particular item is indeed a fossil, not a stone or a piece of wood or something like that. Once you get hold of it, what do you do with that? How do you examine
Yeah. Well, so I mean, first of all, don't drop it. That would make a lot of
it?
people unhappy. You can do several things. A lot of these bones from Eastern North America are isolated, which means that you can manipulate them with your hands, and that's important because we're primates, right? We're tactile. And so from that point of view, I know a lot of people, it actually helps with identification of particular features if you can actually turn around the specimen and get an understanding of that. But if it's encased in rock, or something like that, CT scanning, so the same stuff that doctors do when they want to see, a particular injury, right, inside your body, has become a huge technology in paleontology and biology because it allows you to look inside the skeleton without taking the skeleton apart.
In a 3D sense?
In a 3D sense. And you might think, okay, well, why can't you just dig out all the bones from the matrix? Well, there are a couple of reasons. The first is that, God forbid, you might have a microstructure that isn't preserved, right, when you prep it out, or that you have to get rid of to prep it out. So it's minimally invasive. And then there are other things that you simply can't see if you, what we call skeletonizing something. And this is true for living things too. For example, in lizards, there's a very specific example. There is an attachment joint between a couple bones at the back of the skull. And that's held together by ligaments and, soft tissue, right? Lizards are small, and so when you prep them out, it's commonly prepped out, this particular junction. But it turns out that if you CT scan a lizard skull, those bones are actually tightly wound together, right? You can think of it as duct tape. So the thing of it is that that sort of thing for both living things and fossils, right, allows you to kind of see the interaction between in living things, muscles and bone and things like that. And in fossils, it allows a minimally invasive method of looking inside the rock.
How long will you typically work on a particular specimen, or does it vary depending on what it is?
Yeah, it definitely varies, depending on completeness, depending on, what I'm interested in. If I have a tyrannosaur foot, right, and I am interested in describing every single feature and like relating that foot to different tyrannosaurs, right, then it might take a lot longer than if I'm just saying, here's an isolated toe bone, right, and it has some scratches on it that might be, from a feeding event, right, from another animal.
Now, speaking of a Tyrannosaur, I understand you discovered something that the original collectors of these fossils missed, an unknown species of dinosaurs, and you published your discovery in some journals, as I understand. Did your discovery begin with a piece of bone or a fossil? How did you find something that no one else had seen before?
Yeah, so I mean, I think the fossil in question is, what I'm referring to is the Burchettville Tyrannosaur. So it's the only Tyrannosaurid specimen from Delaware. And, this fossil is really fragmentary. It consists of a couple bones from the foot and, an associated vertebra, so a backbone piece from the tail. And this fossil was discovered in, the late 1970s, early 1980s by a group of collectors around the C&D, the Chesapeake and Delaware Canal. And it was put in collections. At that point in time, we really had a poor idea of how the major groups of dinosaurs were related to each other. But in particular, the group that includes tyrannosaurs and birds, the theropods, had a very, what we call, poorly resolved evolutionary tree. We didn't know how the different major groups were related to each other. And we also didn't have the best idea of, which skeletal characteristics allowed referral to a particular group. So this bone was variously, or this set of bones was variously referred to ornithomimosaurs, which are this weird group of, long-necked, ostrich-beaked, bird-like dinosaurs that did have feathers, and then the tyrannosaurs, which are, of course, include T-Rex. Now, what's interesting is that despite being really kind of fragmentary, to my knowledge, this is only one of like three or four associated specimens of tyrannosaurs from the eastern United States. In other words, association means you have multiple bones that are kind of preserved together and that come from a single individual. So even though it's super fragmentary, it's also kind of important. And so I learned about the specimen in must have been 2014, 2015 or so. It was in a catalog of things. when I asked to go in, I kind of had this hypothesis because of the way the foot bones were shaped. It shared some features with this dinosaur from New Jersey called Dryptosaurus. Now, Dryptosaurus is a tyrannosaur. It's a relative of T-Rex, but it's different from T-Rex. It has actually some of the proportionately largest hands of any dinosaur. So you think T-Rex, tiny two,
The
claws.
Little tiny arms and claws,
Yeah. This thing actually has gigantic claws, and they were tipped with these 6-inch-long talons. Really incredible things. You know, that's sort of one distinguishing feature of this Eastern North American Tyrannosaur. Another one is in its foot. So it has sort of these modified foot bones. And I sort of, you know, compared fossils from that one to this fossil. And, you know, over the course of two papers that I wrote, one was sort of on the anatomy. The other one was kind of describing where it fits into the tree. I make the argument that, you know, well, it's maybe not diagnostic enough to give a new name to. So I didn't name a new species. What it is showing is that it is part of probably a group of tyrannosaurs that were distinct to Eastern North America. And this has been a debate for a while, whether there was this group that was distinct to Eastern North America.
With this group that maybe was distinct to North America, did it exist? Did these dinosaurs exist at the same time as the T-Rex that we're all familiar with?
Yes, so that's just the thing. So Dryptosaurus, which is the New Jersey one that's more complete, is existing at basically the exact same time as Tyrannosaurus rex is existing in Western North America. And this one that I was working on is existing at about the time that the really T-Rex-like Tyrannosaurus start to show up. So what I posit basically is, you know, if you think about the classic example is the split up of South America and Africa, right? But continents split up all the time, islands split up all the time, right? Pretty famous example is, you know, the islands of Galapagos, right? There are different species of living and fossil turtles and, you know, iguanas and things like that that are localized to different islands. You know, and this is true for many different places. You have different groups of things on different places. So lemurs, right, on Madagascar, right? Great apes on Africa and, you know, Indonesia and Oceania. And so you have this splitting characteristic of different land masses, right, that have been, you know, isolated for long times. And, you know, whichever way, we can debate the ways in which these different lineages were produced, that the jury's definitely still out. But at the end of the day, there seems to be this characteristic pattern that you can observe in tyrannosaurs of geographic change shaping, right, the distribution of different lineages.
You mentioned this before. Why is it important to, do you think, to understand evolution and isolation, or evolution in the case of isolated areas? Why is it important to understand that today?
Absolutely. That's a great question. One thing I've gotten really interested in is speciation. So how do species originate? And this is something I'm exploring with my advisor in several projects. And there's been a lot of work done on what pushes speciation to occur. So one classic model is that it's called the Dabansky-Muller-Bateson model of speciation. So picture population. Population is interbreeding, right? You know, you have a set of individuals that are interbreeding. Okay, you set up a barrier, right, between one chunk of the population and another, right? And you keep them separated for a time. The idea of this is that once they're able to interact again, right, each population is going to develop distinct genetic characteristics, right, that make the offspring of the two populations, once they come back together, either unable to reproduce themselves, right, or less fit. And fitness, right, in evolution mathematically is defined as the number of offspring an individual produces, right? So a reduction in that associated with interbreeding across two populations that have previously been isolated. So you split them up, you wait, you bring them back together. And if the offspring aren't proliferating, right, there have been these sort of genetic incompatibilities that have occurred in isolation, either population, that once you bring them back together, they can't work well together. And so you get speciation. So that mechanism that isolates species, right, is commonly thought to be either a geographic one, an ecological one. But this is a huge area of research into how species are formed in evolutionary biology. I would say it's one of the sort of fundamental areas of research in evolutionary biology today. And it has obvious consequences for how we understand the biodiversity around us, and how we understand, you know, how biodiversity is gained and lost. Listeners might know there is a biodiversity crisis. We are losing species diversity today. And so the question is, how are species gained and lost, and how do we apply that, right, towards conservation? You know, I work in an ichthyology lab at Yale, and one sort of type of thing we're interested in are these so-called living fossils, the bofin. These are lineages of living things, you know, organisms around today that seem to show very little change in their anatomy and their features over millions of years of time.
So describe the bofin for us. What sure. does it look like today, and what did it look like, well, as far back as we know?
So you have this fish that's found, you know, throughout East North America. It is the sole survivor of a 200 to 250 million year group of fishes that was way more diverse during the dinosaurs. Since about 150 million years ago, they basically all look the same. So they have this blunt head. They have these little tiny whiskers, you know, sensory features at the front of their snouts. They have this long fin on their top half. So that's called the dorsal fin. They have this flap-like tail, and they actually have an eye spot on their tail. And we think this is involved in, you know, sexual display, as well as perhaps defense. So it's this really kind of cool fish in North America. And since it was first described, basically, the consensus has been there's only one species. And we were skeptical of this because people had reported differences among different areas, right? And, you know, one species across like all of Eastern North America, that's the sole survivor of this one really old group of fishes and looks identical to everything in the fossil record, basically, that ought to raise an eyebrow. So we kind of looked into this question, and we basically threw everything we had at it. You know, we sequenced a lot of DNA from a lot of different fish from across the Eastern U.S. We have a huge amount of co-authors on this paper, so a lot of people were involved in this project.
And were these all were these all researchers at the Peabody or at Yale?
No, they were. You know, we had people at Tennessee Valley Authority, places in the Field Museum, you know, American Museum. We had folks, you know, who contributed information from KU, so all across the United States. And sort of what we ended up coming together to work on was this, and I should say we also, you know, this included, you know, really, really, really helpful work by folks working locally, right? So again, Tennessee Valley Authority, Nicholls State University in Louisiana, you know, they're just this very big, very good collaborative research team. And we just ended up compiling this really big data set of genetic data as well as skeletal data by CT scanning, again, looking inside the skulls of these things to sort of test the hypothesis. Is there only one species? Turns out we think there were two. And this second species split from the first known species pretty recently, like 2 million years ago, we think. So this is important because it suggests, you know, there's recent species diversity being generated in this really old lineage that shows very little like morphological diversity, right? So very little diversity in its skeleton, right, between the living things and the fossil things. And we think it's a geographic split. It's this very common Mississippi River drainage through the Great Lakes, right, down in Louisiana, and then the eastern seaboard, particularly the southeastern U.S., that seaboard, there's that split. That's a very common split among fishes that we think diverged at that age. So it looks like this may have been a geographic speciation event.
So how big is the modern bowfin, and how big was the 200-million-year-old bowfin?
Yeah, that's a good question. So modern bowfin get up to about 30 inches long, so pretty good. But, you know, on average, I'd say they're about a foot long. So they're big fish, you know, comparatively. We have much bigger ones in the fossil record. You know, I'm working on a couple of them right now. You know, they were getting, you know, over 3.5, 4 feet long in, you know, the geological past. So we have 4 foot long examples from Wyoming about 50 million years ago. So they were much bigger in the past. Considerably big fish now as well.
I'd like to circle back to the very beginning of what we talked about. and ask you, because you were quite young when you developed this interest in paleontology and dinosaurs, et cetera. What inspired you to get into this field? Was it a visit to Peabody that did it? What got you so interested in the field?
I gotta say, I don't know. I've been interested in sort of, you know, nature and science since I was very, very young. I think, honestly, it probably, I noticed something and I was hooked, but I can't really remember a precise time where I wasn't very interested in science. I gotta sort of say one thing that must have and certainly did help was that, you know, my parents were very, very good about taking me outside and, you know, taking me on hikes and things when I was pretty young. Like, I remember being, you know, in one of those like early 2000s, like backpacks that also had like the baby carrier, right? You know, my mom would like feed me Cheerios and we'd go walking. That I think attests to like the importance of like the public spaces, right? That I could walk in with my family. That's so important for people and kids who are interested in nature. Cause again, the way we, you know, we learn, I think, and I, you know, I've seen this in, you know, kids I've taught, is that, you know, you have to expose people to nature. You have to say, you know, look, there it is. This is the process that's going on. And I feel poorly that people think that science is just something that happens in like a laboratory. It doesn't. It happens sitting outside, watching the birds, watching the fishes, saying, what can I observe here? Going out on expeditions, not to like some far-flung place away from your house necessarily, but even to like the local riverbank, right? We had bofin samples from the Connecticut River, right? And kind of just saying, look what's right in front of you. This is the biodiversity. This is what matters. Let's conserve this. Let's protect this, you know, and let's be interested in this. Because at the end of the day, it's a health thing, certainly. You know, we want to make sure the planet is safe. And I also want to say, like, there is definitely something to be said for it's very nice to have nature around you. That's an end in itself, in my opinion. So I very much attribute, I think, my interest to like having that around. As someone who's very fortunate to have the interest that I do, that's so important.
Jay Sprownstein is a senior studying ecology and evolutionary biology at Yale. He's also a research associate at the Stanford Museum and Nature Center. Thanks so much for sharing your enthusiasm and time with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We want to let you know about some of the other stories the Full Story team is working on. Adaptive sports is one of them. We speak with people who head up two programs in Connecticut that make team sports accessible to people with physical challenges, one for basketball and the other for hockey. If you've been involved in adaptive sports, we'd like to hear your story. You can email us at tfs@wshu.org, leave a message on our Facebook page at Full Story Radio, or head over to Instagram, also called Full Story Radio. That's our program for today. Produced by Fatou Sangare, Sophie Camizzi, and senior producer Ann Lopez. I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story.